Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, Tuesday, the 25th of February. A fairly light agenda, but incredibly important agenda indeed. And we're very pleased to have with us, as always, our friend Rick Pipercorn, Dr. Rick Pipercorn, who is WHO's representative in the occupied Palestinian territory, who is joining us from Gaza. So I'm going to throw over to you, Rick, right away, and thank you in advance for joining us here once again. Rick, over to you. Okay, now we can't hear you. So can we...
Can you hear me now?
Now we can. Go ahead, Rick.
Okay. So good morning to all and greetings from Gaza. I want to focus on the three topics. I mean, polio, medevac, and some general health issues. But let's start with polio. So the currently a polio campaign is ongoing. It's in coordination with and support and managed by the Ministry of Health, WHO, UNICEF, UNRWA, and many partners. This campaign has two goals. First of all, is of course to stop the transmission of the polio virus within Gaza after the discovery of positive environmental samples to ensure that we do not get polio cases in Gaza. The second goal or objective is to prevent the spread of poliovirus to neighboring countries and territories. So the total number of children under the age of 10, the target was 591,000. After 3 days of the campaign, over almost 548,000 children have been vaccinated. So this represents a coverage over 92%. And just to give you some figures, in the first day, over 261,000 children were vaccinated. In day two, 193,000 children were vaccinated. And in day three, 94,000 children were vaccinated. I was in the north, and Saturday the campaign kicked off there. And again, I was happily surprised how well vaccinations are received in Gaza. Drones of parents bringing in their children, even in very complex areas in the north. In the north of Gaza, we've seen, of course, an almost 500,000 people moving from the south to the north since the ceasefire. So the conditions also really kind of changed. So despite some of the rain and definitely the cold weather, campaign has been going on relatively well. Today and tomorrow is what we call the catch-up days, and then we should have a second round in 4 weeks' time. It's a massive operation. You talk about 16 vaccination teams, 12 on the social mobilizers. I already said why this campaign is needed. After environmental samples were positive in Derbala and Khan Yunis, collected in December and December 24 and January 25. So they confirmed the continuation of the circulation of the poliovirus. We've seen two previous vaccination rounds in the Gaza strips, which were successfully conducted in September and October, reaching over 95%, and we hope to reach that same target. But then in the first polio campaign in September, October, we had, of course, challenges. We had these area-specific humanitarian zones, but we had some areas outside those zones. And in the second round, we missed approximately 7,000 to 8,000 children in the north of Gaza. So sustained peace is crucial not only for polio campaign, but for all the vaccine-preventable diseases. Ensuring that all children can build their overall immunity is also essential to provide access to healthcare, clean water, sanitation, and proper nutrition. Because this polio outbreak is not coming in a vacuum. It's coming in an environment of severely challenged water and sanitation conditions, nutrition conditions, and an enormous increase in infectious diseases. That's on polio. Let me move to medevac. So between the 1st of February, I mean, almost the start of the ceasefire, and 24 February, 889 patients, including of which 889 patients, of which 335 were children, have been evacuated through the Rafah crossing. So this brings, including their companions, this brings the total number of patients evacuated since October 2023 to 6,300, including, and it's almost 4,650 children. We know that before the ceasefire and before the Rafah closure, almost 4,900 children, 4,900 patients were evacuated, of which then over 4,000 children. But after the Rafah Rafah closure, through Kerem Abu Salem, only 460 patients were medevaced, of which 271 were children. We hope to get started as well to medevac to Jordan soon. And we hope, of course, we still plea to expand the medical corridors for medevac, not just through the Rafah crossing, which is now daily between 40 and 50 patients plus companions. We need to expand the medical corridors, but because we estimate that between 12, 10, and 14,000 patients, severe critical patients, are in need for medevac, of which roughly an estimated roughly like more than 4,000 children. So it's absolutely needed that we expand the medical corridors, and that including the corridor to the East Jerusalem hospitals and the West Bank. Otherwise, we will be medevacing for years to come. My last point is a little bit to the and I think all of you read or have probably seen the interim rapid damage and needs assessment, so-called IRDNA. And that was from October 23 to October 24. So it's incomplete. But when you look at health, and I just want to focus on health, the structure of healthcare infrastructure includes the complete or the partial destruction of 772 health facilities, with an estimated economic damage of US $1.3 billion. It includes significant damages to hospital. Almost 95% of the hospitals are partly or severely damaged. Private facilities, 91%, public health centers, 88%, alongside critical facilities such as pharmacies, dental practices, maternity clinic, the only psychiatric hospital, etc. A larger share of the damage, is over 809 million, comes from destruction of hospital. And the Gaza governorate borns the brunt of this. I mean, like, you estimate 682 million of losses in the north of Gaza. Now, the health sector in Gaza has sustained losses totally an estimated 6.3 billion, significantly impacting its functionality and service delivery, and attributed to disruption of healthcare services, the loss of human resources for health, including those killed and injured. And the sector faces, of course, productivity losses, with over 1,700 health workers reported as missing or maybe have fled, leading to a staggering 2.7 billion lost in productivity. So increasing, in addition, increasing burden of diseases, including the rise in injuries, infectious diseases, malnutrition, mental health issues, had added 3.2 billion to the overall health-related losses. So the total needs estimated over the next decade is more than 7 billion. And then the first 3 years, you talk about over 4 billion. Then WHO also, our own operational response plan is very much in line with the flash appeal, but also with our IRDNA, which on health, the WHO team were part of developing that, and including the plans to address that. So our own WHO operational response plan for 2025 has a budget of almost 640 million. And that sounds like a lot, but more than half of that, roughly 250 million, is ongoing humanitarian health support. You talk about essential health services, public health, intelligence, coordination. And of course, as the basis of all of that, the whole operation supplies and logistics, think essential medicines, medical supplies, medical equipment and fuel. The humanitarian health, expanded humanitarian health support. And the other 250 to 300 million is, of course, when we move into a more hopefully sustained peace process for early recovery, rehabilitation, and reconstruction. And I want to close maybe with that one. So in the when I was around on Friday and Saturday and in the north of Gaza, and currently in the south, in the north of Gaza, I went back to Kamal Adwan and to Al-Ada and Indonesian hospitals in Jabalia. And get and Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia. Destruction is enormous, but I saw also some positive signs what is possible. When I was there just after the start of the ceasefire, the only hospital in the north which was minimal functional was Al-Ada. Kamal Adwan is very much destroyed and severely damaged, and it was completely non-functional. The same applies for Indonesian hospital that is damaged, not destroyed, they're damaged, but also non-functional. Now in Kamal Adwan, there is an OPD structure, a tented structure, and another structure next to the hospital, which has been set up as an outpatient department, a little bit like a primary healthcare clinic, including a malnutrition, unit, supported by WHO, the OPD with medical supplies, fuel, but also the malnutrition ward with a little malnutrition, I would say OPD, supported with supplies. That was a hopeful sign, and there's plans to have a small field hospital primary healthcare center on the terrain of Kamal Adwan. You know, before that, the hopefully a reconstruction of a pediatric hospital can start. Indonesian hospital, and I think very much thanks to, again, the health workers in Indonesian hospital and the emergency medical team, Mercy, doing a fantastic job. So 3-4 weeks ago, non-functional. Now the emergency ward is functioning for 24 hours. An outpatient department is functioning and restoring the operation theaters. Currently doing only the most needed operations and trauma open when it is needed. But when the OT is finished, etc., being able to do much more. And that's only in a couple of weeks of time with material locally. And I would say, I would call it small rehabilitation and reconstruction. There's work going on too in Indonesia also to get the oxygen plan going again. And those are small, hopeful signs which we should massively expand and support all over Gaza. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Rick. Colleagues are asking if you could share your notes if you haven't already done that, or maybe I just mentioned that Tarek is also online, colleagues, should you have questions for him. So thanks very much for this comprehensive overview. A bit of good news, you said it, sustained peace is crucial. Of course, we would echo that for just about all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip. So, over to you, colleagues. Olivia of Reuters.
Thanks very much for this briefing. If I may, I have three questions. The first, can you just confirm the figure is 548,000 children who have been vaccinated in this latest round? The second, you said that there is a need to expand medical corridors. What is preventing that from happening? What challenges are you facing in that regard? And finally, if I may, I would also like to ask a question about the West Bank with reports of camps there being cleared out. What pressures is this putting on the healthcare system there in terms of sanitation, civilian casualties? And how concerned are you at the World Health Organization that you could be stretched across two areas now in major need for urgent medical care and assistance? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me try to address your question. So first, back on the polio figure. So the target is 591,000 children under 10. And currently, 547, if I really want to be surprised, by yesterday, 547,848,000 children have been receiving the vaccine, polio vaccine. So today that will be more, it will be probably, yeah. So you can say 548,000 by yesterday received the vaccine, which represents over 92% of the target. And that is actually all over Gaza. So this time the campaign, because it was a ceasefire, we didn't have to do it according to zones. So the campaign was all over Gaza. 3 days campaign and 2 days what we call mop-up. And they're currently, so the campaign started on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, the 3 days campaign. And today and tomorrow are the so-called mop-up days. So that's a remarkable achievement. And personally, I didn't think we would reach that over the 90%, because I know that the first campaign in September, October, you know, there was so much enthusiasm also for people to get out of the street. There was this humanitarian pauses. And I thought, well, let's see if we get the same type of enthusiasm. And I think it says something first about the Ministry of Health, WHO, UNICEF, UNRWA, and all partners on the ground. The more than 1,660 vaccination teams, the 1,200 social mobilizers, the supervisors, and specifically the mobile teams had to do a huge, enormous, like from the 660 vaccination teams, there were roughly 400 fixed sites and over 1,250 mobile teams. And after the first day, we noticed that less people actually went to the fixed sites, and so more. We even brought in more mobile teams all over the place. The micro planning was very complex because of the massive population shift over the last week since the ceasefire. But I think the overall results better than expected. The Medevac, you asked a question. Yeah. So what we have been arguing for this all along. We expect between 10 and 14,000 critical patients which need to be medevaced. We discussed what happened during the war and the crisis before the Rafah closure and after, and now during the ceasefire. So between 40 and 50 patients and companions per day going through the Rafah crossing. That's too little. We really welcome Jordan, the announcement from Jordan. That we actually, that more and more, that will actually open up another corridor when it's happening. So we hope that this starts as soon as possible. But of course, the traditional pathway was always to East Jerusalem hospitals and to the West Bank. We want to restore that. We've been requesting for that, currently not allowed by the Israeli authorities, and we're constantly pressuring on that, because the East Jerusalem hospitals have made plans for that, and the West Bank hospitals, and that would be, it would be such a welcoming corridor, and it would be also, I think, the most efficient. And then from there, from the West Bank, East Jerusalem, or from other places, if some of the patients need specialized care and they cannot get in those hospitals, well, we need to organize Medevac to other countries. Your last questions were on the West Bank, and apologies, I should have said something about that. Incredibly critical. This morning there was a humanitarian country team briefing on the Medevac, a very specific briefing, and maybe you should get that one. I think everyone is incredibly concerned about the current developments. And of course, this has an implication on health, not only on, if you look at the death and injuries between the 1st January, 13th February, 18, first 13th February, not even today, 82 Palestinians have been killed there, and including 25 in Jenin, 10 in Tubas, and I think 9 in Tulkarem. We see the current flashpoints of violence. We have seen attacks on the health since in 20 since 2023, starkly rising in the West Bank, 737 health attacks since October 2023, 44 health attacks documented in the West Bank between the 1st of January and the 13th of January. There's almost 40,000 people displaced. I mean, what we get, the severe movement restrictions. And that is, of course, affecting all services, but very much including health. And then it comes on top. There was already this fiscal crisis from the Palestinian authorities very much affected health and health services before this crisis. So as WHO, what we try to support is pre-positioning supplies as much as possible in, let's say, key hospitals in the West Bank. Then also, there is always an ongoing trauma care program, which is also currently going, and trauma care training from community level all the way up to the third level hospitals, what is ongoing. There's a mission, actually WHO mission this week, going to Nablus to do exactly that. I mean, like to expand on the trauma care program, but also assess other needs, and specifically on the preposition of supplies. I want to also raise here UNRWA and other partners. They do what they can on services and not just on health. So it's important that that continues. But yeah, deeply concerning. And if I get that presentation on the West Bank, which was very good in the HCT, maybe we can share that as well. Over to you.
Thanks, Rick. And just to mention, they have shared the notes with you. And maybe just let me take this opportunity to of course, remind you that the Secretary General yesterday, in his comments to this Human Rights Council, did address the situation in the West Bank. And I'll echo his absolute alarm by the escalating violence therein, including the attacks and large-scale Israeli security force operations in the occupied West Bank's northern governance. Which include the deployment of Israeli tanks for the first time in over two decades. So the Secretary General is absolutely alarmed by this escalating violence, and he's obviously calling all, as he has been since the beginning of this conflict, particularly the recent conflict, for peace, sustainable peace. We have a few more questions for you. Rick, we'll go in the room. Robin of AFP.
Morning, Rick. I've got three questions, but the first one's just a numbers one, so if I start with that one. The 7 billion needs that you talked about, can you clarify, is that only for the health sector?
Yes, that's only for the health sector. That's correct. I think the overall IRDNA, I mean, it's like 43 or 44 billion out of my head. And with regard to health, that is 7. Correct.
Okay, and then just one on hospitals. Oh, there we go. One on hospitals and one on healthcare staff. How many hospitals are, can you just give us an update, how many hospitals are operating in the Gaza Strip today, and what level of functionality are they operating at? And secondly, what's the situation in terms of healthcare personnel, particularly in terms of the local staff and also the international teams that have come in? Is there anywhere near the numbers that are required? Thank you.
Okay. On the health and health functionality and access, the numbers are a little similar as I think we presented last time, like roughly half, 18 out of 36 hospitals in Gaza are what we call partly functional. And 59 of the 144 primary healthcare centers are partly functional. In addition, there's a number of field hospitals, five field hospitals and seven, I would say, smaller field hospitals operational. And I think it's, by the way, it's something to stress again that we get also this question during this crisis and this war, that the health services and health infrastructure, health service has collapsed. It has not. And It is partly functional, in some areas minimal functional, but it has not collapsed. And I really credit that to the resilience of the Gaza health workers, together with huge support and very effective support from WHO and partners, including those emergency medical teams. And I think currently we, out of top, we have 33 emergency medical team in, and they've provided more than 2.5 million consultations already since they are, and most of it, it's that process started in December, January, I'd say January 2024, an increasing number of emergency medical team. And some of them are incredibly, I would say, effective. And specifically when they are linked to existing infrastructure. And to give you an example, Shifa Hospital, which was largely destroyed or severely damaged, is and was non-functional for a while, is currently working as a referral hospital. And it is WHO we support with essential medicine, as we constantly do, essential medical supplies, fuel. But we also support now with a national emergency medical team. And but also an international medical team, UK Med, is active there as well, which we support. Now, Nasser Medical Complex is the largest hospital in the south, was non-functional. I mean, everybody remembers that it from last year, February, when there was a siege and WHO had to help with medevacking of the last patients and staff, completely non-functional and severely damaged. At the moment, that hospital is more than partly functional. Almost all departments are functioning again. And there's, again, Palestinian health workers supported with a group, a number of EMTs, and it's largely not only UK Med, MSF, MAP UK, a number of partners active in that hospital. And I think this is probably the most effective way. One EMT focusing on rehabilitation, the other one on specialized surgery, the other one on maternal and childhood, and obstetrics, et cetera, like that, together with Palestinian health workers. I would say that is the big, and also it shows what is feasible. And we've demonstrated again with polio, but also with what I already see, the current rehabilitation and rehabilitation, early recovery was going on, both in Shifa, but even that small rehabilitation in Kamaladwan or in on Indonesian hospital is remarkable. And that is possible when there is a ceasefire. So I think, as my colleague already rightly says, for all areas, also specifically for health, it's absolutely essential that that ceasefire holds and that it will be transferred to a sustained peace process, because much more will be possible in Gaza.
Absolutely. Thank you Over very you. Much. Thank you, Rick. And of course, we applaud the valiant efforts of our Palestinian colleagues or the Gaza health workers under these extreme circumstances. We still have a few more questions for you, Rick. Let me check to make sure there are none in the room. Okay, in that case, we'll go online. We'll turn to Gabriela of El Proceso. Gabby.
Hi, Rolando. Thank you very much. I have a question on another subject for WHO.
Okay, let's go back to you on that case. In that case, Gabby, let's exhaust questions on OPT first. If you could hold on to that question. Satoko Yomiuri.
Yes, thank you very much for Rolando.
Okay.
Last month, Dr. Pipakon, you just before the ceasefire took effect, you talk about the deployment of the temporary prefabricated clinics and hospitals. So could you give us update on this? The reason why I'm asking you this is there are reports that Israel has not allowed any of the mobile homes to enter Gaza, which is also a part of the ceasefire deal. So could you talk about prefabricated clinics and hospitals? Thank you.
WHO is actually in, we are busy now, and we were planning for that, and we had hoped to get that in by March. We still hope to get that in by March, and what we call a prefab hospital, and then we link it to a partner. So we're still planning for that. And of course, we will have to negotiate the entrance. We have good hopes that we will manage that, and we will report to you when we are not managing that. Yeah, we get, I cannot report. You should have to ask my colleague, or also Jan, something like on the mobile homes and other things. That's not my area. There are issues there, and including still, I get also something from international NGOs in some of the items related to field hospitals, that there are still issues getting them in. That is true. But prefab hospitals or WHO plans that in. I want to make a point, though. If, of course, we all hope, we know it's fragile, that we get into a sustained peace process, then, of course, it's the Palestinians and the Palestinians, the Palestinian government, together with the UN and for health, WHO and partners, to plan for the way forward. And if you look at Gaza, the planning for the way forward, you want to make sure that you plan as effectively as possible for health services in the future. So there should be some lessons learned there as well. We always talk about primary healthcare, but let's say before the crisis, maybe primary healthcare could have been strengthened. And maybe there's not a need to rebuild all those 36 hospitals, but focus on the ones which are absolutely needed and make sure that you strengthen primary healthcare and the referral pathway related to that. That is not, I think, that's those analysis and initial planning is already ongoing. That is something, I think, for the, there should be Palestinian solution for that. And the government, together with UN and partners, which are will then pushing this forward. And I would really hope that on the short, medium and longer term, yeah, we do this as realistic and effective as possible. And we know that a health system based on primary healthcare is the most effective in that sense. You need proper referral hospitals, of course, at all levels, etc., but you need a strong primary healthcare services. We have to think differently in some areas. If you talk about mental health, and I've raised this many times, you have to ensure that mental health is not only integrated in all levels of health services, but there need to be probably a community approach to mental health. Gaza used to always to have strong NGOs, Gazan NGOs, and we would hope they would be, and they are already currently working, they will be strengthened and revived as well to assist in all of these areas. Over to you.
Thank you again, Rick. Okay, we have a question now from John Zarakostas, France von Kat, and the Lancet. John. Okay, we seem to be having a problem with your audio, John. Maybe mute and unmute, let's try that. If not, we'll move on to the next question. Maybe if you can disconnect and reconnect, John, sorry about that, or pose your question in the chat. We'll take a question from Nick, New York Times.
Rick, a couple of questions. Could you just give us an overview of the number of hospital beds that are operational and what the prefab hospital will add in terms of capacity? A second question is, you've talked a lot about the critical role of the Palestinian health staff. Quite a lot were detained by IDF during the 15 months operations. Have they, including some kind of senior doctors and surgeons, have they all been released, or how many of Palestinian staff are still detained? Thank you.
Last question. I unfortunately do not have the numbers, and I think the SWHO, of course, we have been always very clear that this detained health workers need to get back, as need to be treated accordingly to international humanitarian law, but also need to get back as to Gaza as soon as possible. It's a very, that was, has always been a really concerning development. And I think we have consistently raised this during this crisis. I think on human resources, I just want to say, like before the crisis, there were, we talked about roughly 25,000 health workers. Now, I want to make the point that a lot of the senior medical specialists, a lot of senior medical specialists, a large group, they fled Gaza. And this is what we're seeing in some of those, let's say, medical specialist areas, that there's very few left. We, of course, hope if there would be a sustained ceasefire that a number of them will return back to Gaza, because they were there. You talked about, and so people always ask, like, how many of the original staff do you think is currently working? It's difficult to estimate. I hear figures ranging from 50% to 40% of the original health workers, I mean, like, which are still, let's say, operational Gaza, because you also discuss about all this other service, the pharmacies, the labs, etc. There's so many additional health workers need us, and a lot of them, and if you look at all those hospitals, which we still consider partly functional, this area, that, yeah, there's definitely a lack of staff. And that's why this EMTs, the emergency medical teams, and in future, we also would like to get some specialized medical teams in, are essential to work hand in hand with our Palestinian colleagues. And if you get a more in a ceasefire process, as for example, specialized medical teams on areas like oncology, we always, because we talked trauma all the time, but all these non-communicable diseases, oncology, diabetes, the complex cardiovascular, etc., that is definitely in need for more, I would say, specific medical specialists and their teams. That would be needed as well. On the number of beds, there used to be 3,000, more than 3,500 beds. And I think on the lowest, it was like 1,000, 1,100. I think now it's probably back to 1,500. It's not just bringing in a prefab hospital with a couple of hundred beds, etc. What is now already going on, like in Shifa, plans to add another 200 beds. And currently, the renovation, the rehabilitation process is ongoing, and actually, it's already in a much more advanced stage. And I was really impressed when I saw that. So that's currently ongoing to add 200 beds in Shifa. The same in Nasser Medical Complex to add 200 beds. And I think the Ministry of Health and partners are looking at like that, like which hospitals and which are the hospitals which could add beds and in which area where that needed. And then in addition, maybe a few of those prefab hospitals, or when hospitals are severely damaged, a temporarily prefab structure next to that hospital or within the compound of that hospital, while when peace processes will be ongoing, well, those hospitals could be properly rehabilitated or reconstructed. Over to you.
Thank you, Rick. We have a few more questions for you. I'm going to start off by reading one in the chat from Musa of Al Mayadeen. He asks, he refers to a Guardian article. The Guardian newspaper quoted doctors in Gaza as saying that they were subjected to humiliation and beatings during their arrest by Israeli forces. Do you have any information about this matter? He asks.
We heard these stories too, but I think, you know, we cannot confirm them. And we, well, yeah, we saw that news and those stories go around. But no, I cannot confirm. We don't have specific information on that.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. And of course, if any information comes to light, we'll share that with you colleagues. Still a few questions remaining on the platform. Maya of UN Brief, or The Brief. Maya.
Thank you very much for taking my question. Rolando. I wanted to ask Dr. Peppercorn regarding the funding of WHO operations in Gaza, given the news of, you know, withdrawing pending of the new US administration to funding WHO. And of course, we know that UNRWA is still not being funded. And it's until March that I think there was something when Biden decided to cut funds. They said that according to some legislative agreement in the US, only March 2025, it would be perhaps reinstated. And what you see is the situation, and do you have enough adequate funding to continue operations at the level you have been doing for the next 3 to 6 months? Thank you.
Maybe if Tarek, is also online, he might want to add to this. So Tarek, you want to start or shall I start focusing on OPG?
Yep, Tarek.
Hi, Rika. Well, you may want to speak specifically on Gaza when it comes to overall impact. Dr. Tedros was speaking to executive board, you will remember, saying that that unfortunately the any cut in funding will have consequences on different programs of WHO. What we need to do from our side is really try to diversify funding, try to mobilize more resources through the platforms that have been created in past years during this transformation process, such as investment round, WHO Foundation, and member states, you will remember, have agreed to increase assessed contributions by 20% at the latest executive board. We also will introduce cost-saving measures when it comes to logistics, operations, travel, staffing, and we will also engage with the U.S. To have this constructive dialogue. So this is it on the funding on general level. I don't know, Rick, if you have anything specific on Gaza.
Yeah, I want maybe some more specific points. I mean, I think Tarek, I think that's also been very much said by WHO, DG, and others, that we hope, of course, this will be reconsidered and reviewed. And because when you talk about global health, and also specifically global health security, we all know you talk about collaboration and you don't talk about isolation. And even as I just want to take it even a little bit more personal for myself, that I'm a medical doctor. I did a postdoc at Johns Hopkins University. And everywhere around my career, over more than 35 years, everywhere in Africa and in Asia and here, you know, I work with African institutions, if it is the many top public health schools in the US, but also with CDC, NIH, etc. I mean, like, that's all part of working on global health. So it's the implication of funding is one thing, but also the whole collaboration, technical collaboration, etc. is another major aspect. Now on OPT. We were, I think, lucky that we have a diverse group of partners and donors. I mean, and for the from the start of this this crisis, like almost 30 different partners. Of course, the US is also a really important partner of that, and a large partner with the EU and all the European countries, etc. But luckily, also in the region, we get support, UAE, Saudi Arabia, etc. I mean, like, so there is unfortunately a diverse group. And when we look at it and we presented the WHO plan, the report of 2024 and the plan for 2025 for OPT. So that is, of course, the West Bank, East Jerusalem and Gaza. And with a budget of 640 million. So we appeal to this wide group of partners, as Tarek also said, globally, but we specifically here for OPG. And I think WHO, if we have proven anything on the Gaza response, then we've proven to be extremely operational and very effective. And we have been within the one UN and part of leading and coordinating health. And if I just say some of the figures on the medical supplies and the essential medicines for surgery, like you talk about more than 7 million treatments, you know, which have been provided in Gaza, consultations due to those supplies during the crisis. Almost 80% of the medical supplies and essential medicine came in through WHO. More than 9 million liters of fuel delivered to health facilities and hospitals. We talk about facilitating, supporting, and I'm only talking about the 2024, up till 2024 response, 5,300 medevacs. The EMTs, the 33 emergency medical teams, have been brought in, facilitated, and supported. And then specific areas in maternal and child health, mental health, rehabilitation and reconstruction already going on a smaller scale. And so we've proven to be very operational, but also effective, and that we actually spent the resources in the right way. Of course, we need to continue in doing that. The needs are enormous in this humanitarian phase. And the needs are even bigger when we talk about early recovery and rehabilitation. So we really appeal to all partners, et cetera. And I really hope that also with regard to the US is reviewed and reconsidered, because not just for the funding, but also as a technical partner. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Rick. Okay, we're going to try John again. John Zarakostas.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Great. Good morning. Thank you, Rick. I was just on your last answer. Can you elaborate a little bit, how much has the freezing of the US participation in the WHO and in the aid community affected your operations on the ground? How helpful were the US teams in facilitating the movement of supplies through the various checkpoints? And if you notice that missing. And secondly, with reference to the rehabilitation of the medical centers, can you elaborate a little bit? If I recall rightly, some of the prosthesis facilities had been damaged as well. Do we know if the clearance has been given for these facilities to be up and running? And if you have an update on the number of amputees, I think in your last assessment that stopped in May 2024, it was about 4,000. Do you have an update on that? Thank you.
So, John, thanks very much. So, unfortunately, the amputees, I don't have. I will check again with my team here, also better in Gaza, and if I have, you know, better information on that, we will get back to you. On the overall, and maybe again, Tariq might want to come in with the overall, the impact of the U.S. funding. But we, as I said, we presented and shared the WHO operational response plan for 2025, and then our report over 2024. And we've been doing this from the start of the crisis. I think we were on it first. In already November 2023, we had an operational response plan and focusing along the most important areas, of course, maintaining life-saving essential health services, the public health, strengthening the public health intelligence and early warning and prevention and control, health emergency coordination, and everything underpinned by the medical supplies, medical equipment, and fuel. And then, of course, the fourth objective was always early recovery, rehabilitation, reconstruction, which is now much larger. So when I look at the 2025 plan, and we shared that and we presented that with partners, we got that question as well from partners. So for us, the US came in relatively late as a support, but they became a very important supporter. And in many different areas, I mean, on medical supplies, essential medicine, also human resources, etc. So currently we are directly affected here. If you look at it financially, we are affected by 46 million dollar, which is which we cannot use at the moment, which we cannot allocate. And we had planned, of course, to use the majority of that here in 2025. So, of course, that is an impact. And we are looking to other partners and member states and donors. Currently, we still can continue our operations in Gaza, but we've been very clear while presenting our 2025 plan that we need, of course, as much as possible, flexible funding in the pipeline. And if member states cannot provide flexible funding according to our plan, we are very much open to specific funding on specific areas, if it is on coordination, or if it is specifically focused on early recovery, or more on the humanitarian area, essential health services, supplies, etc. And we hope to balance this as good as possible. So, yeah, of course, any key donor and a key partner where funds cannot be used, that will be an impact. I mean, like, I would be lying if that was not. Again, we were lucky that we had a group of 30 artists, and we hope to expand and even more diversify and continue. What is absolutely needed is that in the areas I discussed, that we can continue to do our work. And we've been proven that we, for the one within the one UN and partners, we're leading and coordinating, but also that we have been super operational on the ground and delivered under the most difficult circumstances. Over to you.
Yeah, let me just make a general comment. And of course, if Jens was here, he would say this, I suppose. I mean, that the UN humanitarian agencies are always looking for new sources of funding to match the growing humanitarian needs around the world, which are indeed growing exponentially. So to Rick's point. Rick, I hope you have a few more minutes. We still have a few hands up, if you could indulge us, starting with, firstly, I just want to make sure, Tarek, if you have anything to add, just throw your hand up. But we'll take a question now from Jamie of the AP.
Thank you, Dr. Pieperkorn. Nice to see you again. You just mentioned 46 million that you cannot use. Can you be specific as to where the impact of where that money was allocated, and what specific programs or projects or assistance is going to be affected because of that lack of that money?
Yeah, I think I will try to be as specific as possible. So the freezing of those funds for us here in WHO OPT would leave six areas underfunded. And we raised this as well during our presentation with partners and then overall, and now we are having specific discussions with member states and partners. So the area of procurement of supplies, it's actually all across. It's enabling the enabling of the emergency medical teams, which I just discussed also how relevant they are. The partner coordination, which is a critical role. I mean, as WHO leading the cluster and the partners, including fuel. The rehabilitation of some of the key facilities, part of the medevac operations, and some of the protection areas as well. It's a smaller. Now, we of course made sure that other partners also cover this partly, but as I said, 46-47 million is a large sum of money, and it would have been so incredibly helpful in 2025. I mean, like, that we could have used this money for these areas. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Rick. Okay. Yeah, quick follow-up. Go ahead, Jamie.
Thank you, Dr. Pieperkorn. Just very quickly on that, you said that part of the medevac operations will be affected on that. Does that mean that fewer people are getting out of Gaza because of the limits in funding?
No. And I want to make sure that currently we are still going full steam ahead. We had some funds still left in the pipeline and some funds committed. And approximately 40 to 60 million, I said, we still had either in the pipeline or, you know, we carried over. So we are still going full steam ahead on all the areas I mentioned. But of course, our plans are not just, it's for the whole of 2025. And then, of course, 2026 and beyond. And I mentioned that when we, only for WHO, so we estimate we need for the humanitarian areas roughly 250. And then when early recovery and rehabilitation and reconstruction start, another 250 to 300. So we need, and I think, and we did relatively well with resource mobilization from the start of this crisis up till now. And we expect also from the 30 partners that we continue along that way, that everybody sees first, hey, everybody will see the needs, but also that this money has been really spent well. And we can give you again the overview on, for example, the our report of 2024. And if you look at the achievements there, I think they're really remarkable for a mid-sized team of WHO in Jerusalem, Gaza, and the West Bank. So we I described the areas of support. We made, of course, sure that there's other partners who also cover part of that area. So currently, we go full steam ahead with Medevac. And as I said, we are looking forward to expand those operations, including with the medical supplies and essential medicines. But we need to do that for the full 2025, 26 and beyond. So for that, we definitely need substantial more flexible funding or even specified funding on the areas in the key areas related to our operational response plan. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Rick. I think that exhausts the questions for you. So if I'm correct, yes, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you, as always, once again, for joining us, briefing our journalists here. And note correctly, WHO has a mission this week to Nablus. So if that's the case, then good luck with that. And we do look forward to hearing back from you on how those efforts go. So thank you once again. Tarek, I think you're online. We have a couple of questions. I haven't forgot you, Gabby. We also have a question in the chat from Christiane, but we'll start with Gabby. I think this could be for Tarek. So Gabby, over to you.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, Tariq. Chinese researchers have found that a newly discovered bat coronavirus could at some point spread to humans like COVID-19. Is this a matter of concern for WHO? Are we going to have a briefing on this? Or if you can give us your thoughts about this, or what are your findings? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gabriela. We are aware of this study that has been published recently, and now our technical teams are looking into it and discuss it. What is really important is that to know that research on new pathogens or re-emerging pathogen is really important, and it's crucial for formulating public health policies, but also for preventing outbreaks. Now, any such research and lab research has to be done in a transparent and safe way. So there has to be protocols that are followed. WHO has published laboratory safety guidance and manuals, setting really up on how this research should be regulated by national authorities and what exactly practices should be followed at the lab level. So research is important, but it has to be safe and transparent.
Well noted. Thank you very much, Tarek. Okay, Christiane.
Thank you. My question on Mpox, Tarek answered in the chat. I was wondering whether you have the statement today, but he said, well, this is just for the people in the room who might not read the chat.
Thanks. I have another question.
Let's go back to that, because there was another question in chat. We don't know. And how emergency committee works is that there are members of emergency committee. They discuss the issue and they formulate their recommendation to the director general on whether a particular health event should continue to constitute public health emergency of national concern. It takes some time, this process. So I understand that we would all like to know whether this outcome will be available tonight, or we can all just go and relax and have it, and we will have it tomorrow. But we work really in a real time, and once we have a news, we give that news immediately. So right now, I cannot tell you if we will have an outcome of third meeting of emergency committee on MPOX tonight, or it will happen tomorrow.
Am I still on?
You're still on.
Yes, I had another question, Tariq. This is about mysterious disease in Congo that I read news reports about. People die within 48 hours. It's a hemorrhage fever, but not one of the known ones. Do you know anything about this? Doctors at the Bikoro Hospital have talked about this, and there have been 419 cases since the 21st of January.
Yes, this information has been published in an outbreak newsletter of our regional office for Africa, and I will share in a chat the link to it. I know it's complicated to open the link, but you please copy the link and put it in your browser. So yes, there was in a northwestern Equator province, two clusters of cases of deaths from unknown disease have emerged, resulting in hundreds of cases and dozens of deaths. Those outbreaks, which have seen cases rise rapidly within days, pose a significant public health threat. Now, the exact cause remains unknown, but some 13 samples have been tested negative for Ebola and Marburg. So Ebola and Marburg have been ruled out. So now we are looking into whether it's another infection or it's some toxic agent. We are again talking about remote areas in Congo with a limited laboratory capacities, with limited surveillance capacities, with a really difficult access and difficult infrastructure. So we remember we had a similar situation a few months ago. We need really to support local health authorities to try to get the samples to the relevant laboratories that are closest to the affected areas and try to find this out. But I will send you what we have, what has been published in a weekly epidemiological update from our regional office.
Thank you, Tariq. That would be most helpful. Maya, you have a question for Tariq?
Yes, thank you very much. Hello, Tariq. Yes, can you just explain the difference between if it's a new sort of virus or if it's a toxic agent? What does that mean?
Well, we don't know what it is, but it can be a toxic. It means that there is some element that has been consumed by population and that has been provoking intoxication, or it's infectious pathogen that has been spreading between people or through the vector, like we remember last time, there were lots of cases of malaria. But again, we don't know at this stage, so we need to do more investigations and to support local and national health authorities to do this.
Stay with us, Tariq. I think, Maya, you have a follow-up quickly? Yep.
Yes, a quick follow-up. What do you mean by supporting local authorities? Do they have the infrastructure, the labs capacity to do that? Or do we need intervention from the international community? And what is the situation there given the conflict?
So I lived and I worked in Congo, in the remote areas of Congo. So it is really difficult access. So basically the information first goes from local health authorities, they go up to the regional and then to the national health authorities. Then we have to see really how to get there, because the surveillance in these remote areas is difficult. We don't know really how many people are affected. We cannot do isolation of cases because there is no infrastructure. There is no laboratory. Even just to take the sample, it's not easy. So we have to see what can be done and at what point WHO can support. So we are, because unfortunately, you hear about the Democratic Republic of the Congo all the time. We've been hearing about the situation in the east of the country. We know that there is a current Mpox outbreak. We had these outbreaks of different diseases in the past. So we will. We are in contact, obviously, with the national health authorities, and we are trying to see what exact measures need to be put in place, what it is to send the teams, what these teams should be equipped with, where can we get the samples. And again, what was really important, it was to rule out hemorrhagic fevers like Ebola and Marburg, because we know that those are deadly and we have a high fatality ratio. And I'm just pasting now the link to the document, so you can all have it.
Thank you very much. One more second, we have Jamie, AP.
Good morning, Tarek. Just wanted to follow up on what Dr. Peeperkorn had said. He was very specific about the impact of the U.S. funding cuts in Gaza in terms of the amount of money. Could you just give us a broad picture for WHO altogether? What is the assessed financial impact of the U.S. funding cuts, suspensions? Thank you, please.
Thanks, Jamie. But you have seen really we issued a press release when there was announced suspension of funding for PEPFAR, which is President Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, that caused an immediate stop to HIV treatment, testing, and prevention. So now there was a waiver on that, which was a good news. But we understand it does not include prevention services. So that was the one an example. Dr. Tedros also gave an example of Myanmar, where some 60,000 people will have no access to life-saving services. There could be also impact on polio, on Mpox, and it's not really only to WHO, because we are talking really about funding cuts to NGOs who are working in a health sectors, and we work as a partners. We are really trying to gather all the data on service disruption and to see how we can support countries. But again, just to go back to our main point, we need to diversify funding. You heard that from Jens. This has been identified a long time ago as a risk for WHO, but Jens was saying for the UN in general as well, is that you should not be dependent on few donors. So how to diversify this platform, how to make sure that we have a sustainable and independent funding in a way that we can try to allocate it to different parts of WHO program. So for that, there is an investment round that has been done. We are really trying to get see how WHO Foundation can help. And also, as I said, good news was that countries have agreed to increase the assessed contribution, because that is a part of a core funding that can be allocated in a way. But we will, as Dr. Tedros says, we will have to see how we can prioritize our activities in light of reduced funding. But at the end of the day, we really hope that we will engage in the constructive dialogue with the US, and that the US can reconsider its intent to withdraw from the organization and to cut its funding.
I think Jamie has one more follow-up. Sorry.
Thank you, Tarek. Thank you so much. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear with my question. Dr. Peeperkorn gave us a specific number of the amount of funds that were affected, and so I'm just wondering, what is the specific number for WHO generally? How much? What amount of money are you not seeing that you had expected from the United States? And if you're not able to assess that, then just tell me that. I mean, you know what?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't understand your question. So if you are looking at exact numbers, I don't have those. I can give you the numbers that are being that US was giving in a last biennium, and that what has been expected. But again, there are some different parts of this budget. There is a core budget. There are four segments. So really, if you need exact numbers on specific programs, I don't have that right now.
Okay, well noted. Thank you, Tarek, for taking all those questions and, of course, for delivering Dr. Pipercorn. As always, I think that does it for other questions. So I'm just going to very briefly highlight a couple of points from my side. As you may have seen, we shared with you last night a statement from the spokesperson for the Secretary General on Sudan, through which the SG expresses his deep concern about the announcement by the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, and affiliated civilian actors and armed groups of a political charter that expresses an intention to establish a governing authority in the RSF areas of control. So that's a statement we shared with you after hours last night. In terms of meetings, we have the Committee on the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, CESC, is currently meeting and will conclude, will issue its concluding observations on the reports of five countries that reviewed during this session, namely for Croatia, Peru, United Kingdom, Rwanda, and the Philippines, this coming Friday, the 28th of February. And of course, the Conference on Disarmament also continues today under the presidency of Ms. Ichikawa Tomiko of Japan. Its high-level segment began yesterday. And of course, the Human Rights Council began its 58th session yesterday, as you well know, with statements from the Secretary General, the President of the General Assembly, and High Commissioner for Human Rights. So today, the high-level segment continues, as you will have seen from the statement, or rather the update that Pascal and his team shared with you. I won't go into all the details, but just to mention there is a panel discussion currently underway on the death penalty, and then the high-level segment will recommence this afternoon with 38 dignitaries scheduled to speak. In terms of the council, we also have a press conference to announce in connection with the council session. The group of human rights experts on Nicaragua will hold a press conference tomorrow in this room, the 26th of February, at 11 a.m. to present the findings of its latest reports to the council, which it will present this Friday, the 28th of February, at around 11:30. So the press conference taking place tomorrow at 11 a.m. with Nicaragua experts, and then the report will be presented on Friday. And that is it from me. If you have any questions, no, going once, going twice. Okay, well, have a good afternoon and see you here Friday. Thanks.